From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. Now, this program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. It's a point I've made more than once in recent years. Recording this program on a Thursday for broadcast on the weekend makes covering fast-breaking news impossible. And that's never been more true than in this historic, chaotic week. The minute-by-minute headlines are as unpredictable as they are unbelievable. Never mind, exhausting. Fortunately, our strength is going deeper, examining how we got here and what needs to happen next, independent of the ultimate outcome of the 2020 elections. And so, here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief Radio.
We break and divide every demonic confederacy against the election, against America, against that who you have declared to be in the White House. We break it up in the name of Jesus. We loose confusion into every demonic confederacy directed right now at this election, directed specifically at the six states. We come against people that are working in high levels right now with demonic confederacies and secrecies and demonic plans and networks. We break it up and we command that it be exposed right now in the name of Jesus.
That's the actual White House spiritual advisor actually calling for divine intervention in the U.S. presidential election. How far we've come down a completely predictable, slippery slope. On this week's show, we'll take a look at the role of religion in this campaign, and in the ways it has been used and abused to motivate voters, with Interfaith Alliance President Rabbi Jack Moline.
A blow for President Trump tonight, with part of that blue wall building back for Joe Biden in Michigan and apparently Wisconsin. Now, the president's biggest battlegrounds, the courtrooms in the states that will decide the presidential race.
It was an unprecedented moment in an unprecedented election season. The sitting president of the United States, in effect, claimed victory in a national re-election campaign while something like half of many millions of voters were not yet counted. And he did it in the revered East Room of the White House. Political management expert Greg LaBelle will be back with us to gauge where we are and how we got here. But first,
Souls to the Polls, a series of events to mobilize ministries and their congregations to cast their vote today. Souls to the Polls is a nationwide initiative to get people to go straight from church to the voting booth.
One lasting legacy of the Trump presidency and this campaign season is intense organizing on both sides of the political aisle. Faith-driven leaders and communities made their voices heard and worked tirelessly to both organize and serve Americans whose right to vote was, in many cases, under relentless attack. Nationwide efforts by the grassroots interfaith activist organization Faith in Action included the Rise and Vote campaign, and member groups at the state level were instrumental in helping this happen in the face of unconscionable obstacles. Certainly in Florida, there are many stories to be told, and we are fortunate to be joined by Pastor Rhonda Thomas, Executive Director of Faith in Florida. Pastor Rhonda, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
It's a pleasure being here with you.
What have these past couple of weeks been like for you and for your organization?
Okay. As you know, I do cover a statewide organization. So it's not just like one area. And Florida is extremely huge and can be interesting some days. But we've been very, very busy in the preparation of getting ready for voter turnout. We've been extremely vigilant of what is taking place on the ground when it comes to voter suppression. And we were very, very successful in getting as many people led by our faith leaders out to the polls to vote. So we've been really, really busy. It still is busy.
Please talk about the incredible numbers of people in Florida affected by the Get Out the Vote efforts spearheaded by Faith in Florida and what those efforts look like.
Just to give an example, this is really historic for the African-American community, particularly in the South Florida area of doing what we call Souls to the Polls, led by our faith leaders. We were able to cover 25 counties in the state of Florida, starting from Key West in Monroe County, all the way through the Panhandle. And we were able to engage over 800 congregations to be a part of this effort, to not just lead our congregations to the polls, but the communities that our congregations sit in, along with family, impact folks, making sure that we not just get those persons to the polls to vote, but also to oversee and make sure that they have a wonderful voter experience. Because we know that the level of voter suppression is extremely high in the state of Florida, and Miami-Dade County and Broward County had been declared as ground zero for voter suppression. So we were not just wanting to get people at the polls, but we wanted to make sure that they have one of the best voting experiences, and really monitor and hold one accountable if anyone experience anything less than. And so all of that effort took place with a whole lot of planning by our faith leaders. We targeted our millennials, making sure that they were not just a part of the voting experience and getting to the polls, but we also targeted and planned certain events just for the millennials. That's how important this was for us as far as voter turnout. In the midst of a pandemic, we were still able to practice all safety measures. We gave out a lot of PPE, free food, entertainment, and people really celebrated the fact of being able to vote, knowing that we stand on the shoulders of our grandparents and great-grandparents who did not have the great experience we're able to have in voting.
What are some of the obstacles Florida voters, particularly voters of color, found themselves needing to overcome in 2020?
We've always known that we would have to stand in long lines, and we were willing to stand. Even our senior citizens, the first day of early voting in Miami-Dade County, we had over 60 senior citizens that stood in the rain and they were not accommodated, but they still stood in the rain. We knew that we needed to make sure that our signatures matched as much as possible because we would have been denied the right to vote. We put a lot of emphasis on making sure all of the returning citizens that we fought for in 2018 to get their voting rights restored, that we put special attention with those voters, because this, for some, was their first experience, first time voting, because of we know that we had a problem where returning citizens with a felony conviction could not vote in Florida. But because of the work we did in 2018, they had that opportunity. So we made sure that we put a lot of emphasis and attention around them as well. We know that we have often been purged from the system and not been gotten any type of letter or any type of information saying that we had been purged. We wouldn't find out that we're purged until you actually got to the booth itself. So those are some of the obstacles that we were looking out for to make sure that we can try to de-escalate those kind of situations before it actually occur. Some things we had no control of. Some areas did not have an early voting site. We had one, for example, in Coconut Grove, that's a city that's in the Miami-Dade County area. During the primary, it was an early voting site. During the general, there was no early voting site. So those voters and those communities had to travel 8 miles or more just to get to a precinct. We couldn't understand why was that done, considering early the primary was just in August. We were accommodated. And most of those problems comes from communities of color, in particular the Black community, the African-American community. We did all that we could to make sure that we can counteract and do all what we can possibly do before it got any worse. We had faith leaders actually monitoring the polls as well, who took shifts 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. and only took a break for lunch or just to make sure that voters had a great experience or a better experience. And so those are just a few of the things that we tried to address before it took place. We did notice that there was certain voter precincts that wanted to take temperatures in the parking lot, particularly in the Black community, where other communities, there was no temperatures taken. And so, and not that we had a problem with taking the temperature, but take the temperature in all communities, in all precincts. And so those are some of the things that we saw that was a little unusual, but not surprisingly, that we know that we expect some things to happen in some counties, even more than others. Broward County is always a targeted county. But overall, I think that it was a better experience. What we really cared about is not just getting people out to vote, but that they have a wonderful experience, that their voting rights was protected, and that we wanted to see less voter suppression. And I think that we were pretty good in trying to do all that we could to make sure those efforts were addressed and taken care of.
You know, criticism of advanced polling not reflecting the vote count has been very harsh in recent elections, even as we learn of more and more obstacles being put in the way of young, urban, and minority voters. If a voter tells a pollster how they intend to vote, only to later find themselves disenfranchised, enough of those and the polls will overestimate support for Democrats. Wouldn't that explain how recent inaccuracies may not mean the failure of polling, but rather widespread partisan voter suppression?
Yes, yeah, it will definitely mean that. It does mean that. And I know that I feel that it's strategic as well. Sometimes we don't realize how powerful our vote is until we're put in some of these ongoing crazy circumstances. And I do feel like it's strategic, and there are it's targeted to certain people and communities to detour our voice being heard through our vote. Also, it's a way of being a distraction where it will, because, you know, we think about it, we saw the non-accessibility for our handicap or elderly. And I just think that all of that falls all together, and whether it's a party or a race to suppress our vote, and also to distract us in ways that we wouldn't come out to vote. And even to the point of making it feel as if our vote does not matter. And so we were very, very strategic in doing as much training as possible and encouraging people how powerful their voice is through voting, the voting process. We know that if we don't vote, we just add to the narrative of destroying democracy. And we want to change that narrative. And we did change it. And we are changing it. And it will not stop. I started doing hearings across the state of Florida in 2019, just collecting stories of different voting experiences that one has had. And we realized how our historic Black colleges across the state and how those students were being treated and was a problem, along with people of color, whether it was a language barrier. When it comes to our Haitian community, we realized that that was used as a way of distracting one to get out to vote. And we then began to collect those stories. We sent those stories to Congresswoman Marsha Fudge because we want to know what needs to be done to protect our voting rights. And we thought that we were very successful. And from those stories, that's how we were able to declare what counties would be ground zero for voter suppression. But it also gave us the opportunity to teach and bring awareness of what to look for, because it had almost become a norm. And we want to change what once looked like a norm. It's no longer a norm. And so I agree it all ties in, and it goes beyond even a party. But I think it's just, if it's ever been a time where I can see how powerful the Black vote and vote of color, how powerful it is, it has been during this last electoral season.
I'd like for you, if you would, to talk about the origins of faith in Florida and about how you got involved in this work.
Okay. I got involved in 2012. Just being a pastor, Faith in Florida coming to my office, and at that time it was St. Pico, Florida. Wanting to share information about an amendment that would have brought harm to communities of color. And that's how I really got involved. And I knew that they wanted to really engage congregations overall. And so we do represent multiracial, multi-faith congregations across the state around racial, economic, and social justice. And that's how I really got involved and became a part of this great work in bringing this awareness to faith leaders across the... I started out just strictly in Miami-Dade County. And engaging in so many congregations in just Miami-Dade, which is a huge... Miami-Dade is a state by itself with some very interesting type local politics. But yet knowing that that particular amendment will affect the entire state, It just gave me a platform as a faith leader and also a better understanding of what God has called me to do, knowing that my work goes beyond the pulpit inside of the church, but also to go out into the community to empower as many people as possible, knowing that their voice, how powerful their voice is. And for those who have been neglected and disenfranchised and overlooked, that building a space of belonging, a community of belonging, and just giving them the opportunity of sharing their own story. And what do we do with that story? And how do we collect those stories together to then begin to change policies and holding elected officials accountable? And so I started out as a fellow just in Miami-Dade County, just dealing with the Black church and the Black community. And then I realized how Black and brown folks have so much in common, but there's a strategic plan that keeps us separated. Because if we ever came together, I firmly believe if we can change Florida, we can change this country. If we can bring Black and brown folks together under one umbrella, understanding that we have more in common than what separates us, we can make a difference. And so far, Faith in Florida has become successful across the state in doing just that.
So many on-the-ground activists regularly report that the deep divisions in our society that seem evident in media are far from universal in real life. I remember Reverend William Barber talking about that with great passion right here on this show. Are you finding that to be true? And if so, what does it teach us about bringing Americans together again over shared values and priorities?
I think that's extremely important and can be valued in such a way where our country overall will be looked at differently, and just shared values. And it's even okay to disagree, but yet we can still work together collectively. I think there's such a need for that across the board. But I think also we have a long way. We're far from it for whatever reason. But I think it's still worth the fight of not giving up and still strategizing and creative thinking. And I know that there's still people in this country that care about all people, that gives us hope in the midst of how it may presently look right now.
Would you tell our listeners how they can learn more about Faith in Florida and how they can follow and support your work?
Yes, you can. We're definitely on every social media handle, but our website is www.faithinflorida.org. And we can, and depending on what area of the state that you even may have an interest in, you can see all of that on our website, all the areas that we covered, as well as the just some of the great work that has been done and the success. And so we are, like I said, a statewide organization, but then you'll also see how we're broken down in counties as well. And that's www.faithinflorida.org. Or you can always email me at rthomas@faithinflorida.org.
Pastor Rhonda Thomas is Executive Director of Faith in Florida, part of the nationwide Faith in Action Coalition. Effectively organizing Americans for action and engagement, Faith in Florida is building a powerful, multicultural, nonpartisan network of congregation community organizations for putting values into action. Rhonda, you were there to make sure so many people in Florida overcame manufactured obstacles to cast their votes. And I know the witness of you and your partners will be helpful in voter protection efforts in the years ahead. Thank you so much for what you have been doing in this season of elections. And thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I honor the invite. And please, you be safe as well.
Up next, a look back at the excruciating week with political management expert Greg LaBelle. And later, Interfaith Alliance President Rabbi Jack Moline with thoughts on what multi-faith activists will need to focus on in the weeks and months ahead. If you miss any part of today's program, you can hear full episodes of State of Belief anytime on our website. You'll also find links to the topics we discussed this week, extended interviews and transcripts, and an archive of past shows, all at stateofbelief.com. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, religion and radio done differently. Last week at this time, I was talking with my friend Greg LaBelle, Professor Emeritus of Political Management at George Washington University, about what this past week was likely to look like. Now it's behind us, and Greg LaBelle is back to examine what's taken place. Greg, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton. Here we go again.
Well, a lot of analysts have begun to openly ridicule the Trump campaign's efforts to undermine the democratic process. Are you one of them?
Ridicule would not be the verb that I would choose. I am leery of their efforts. I think their efforts will fail. I continue to be disappointed in this candidate and this administration's willingness to continually challenge our democratic processes. So that's sort of where I am, Welton.
A close result is close to the worst case scenario for many observers. What are your thoughts about that?
I think overall what we see is at least the potential for a rebuff of Donald Trump as president. What we do not see is a rebuff of Trumpism in this country. And that is of great concern to many of us, because as we look, particularly as we look down ballot, as we look at the results in some places, the continual almost 50-50 division of this country, Trumpism is alive and well. And regardless of the results of this presidential election, Trumpism will continue to be part of our lives, much to my regret.
Predictably, the administration's disdain for truth that has so corroded our public discourse has now taken on a life of its own, with partisans creating narratives out of random whole cloth, ballots stolen, ballots falsified, ballots uncounted. Regardless of the outcome, how in the world is anybody going to trust anybody else once this is over?
You have just said the magic word, Welton, and that is trust. Trust in this country has been so greatly damaged over the last 4 years, primarily by this administration, this president, that it becomes, I think, the greatest challenge that we face moving forward. Citizens don't trust their government. The government doesn't trust its citizens. The result is that we don't trust each other as citizens. This is a serious problem. And whatever, however this whole thing ends up, I think the biggest challenge, and there are many challenges that a prospective President Biden will face, but one of the biggest ones it will definitely be, and one of the most enduring ones will be that will be the erosion of trust in this country between and among all of us. And that's what we have to begin to focus on now. I hope we have the opportunity to begin to focus on that now, but it's going to be a long, hard haul to begin to repair the damage that's been done.
We can't know what will happen between the time we have this conversation and the time a listener hears it. With that in mind, though, could you talk about the anticipated dynamics between a President Biden and the kind of legislature we're currently seeing take shape?
Assuming that Joe Biden wins the presidency and is inaugurated on January 20th, he will face considerable challenges with a Senate that appears, and as you say, none of this is really resolved yet, but the possibility that he will face a Senate that is still in Republican hands, still in the hands of Mitch McConnell, the challenges that he faces will be significant in moving his agenda forward. I'm sure McConnell and his folks are already making plans for how to thwart whatever efforts a new administration would undertake. I expect that a big part of the McConnell agenda will continue to be a transformation of the judicial system in this country, not just at the Supreme Court, but all the way down the line. I have no doubt that will be continue to be a focus of theirs. I think if there is a glimmer of hope here, it is that Joe Biden and his 40 plus years in public office, most of which was spent in the United States Senate, makes him probably the president who is most comfortable with and familiar with and able to deal with the United States Senate since Lyndon Johnson. So there may be some hope there. There may be some vestiges of good relations, goodwill between a potential President Biden and members of the Senate. Will that remains to be seen. I think there is a glimmer of hope there, but it's only a glimmer at this point.
Greg, what, in your experience, and you've got a lot of it, what could be a promising tactic for trying to bring Americans, at least those Americans who aren't on the angry fringes, back together around a vision for the common good?
Well, I think we've begun to see that with how Vice President Biden has handled himself since Election Day. In that he is presenting himself in a very reasoned way. He is presenting himself, and he has made a point of saying, I actually like his quote. I ran for president as a Democrat. I will be a president of the American people, and this is quite a significant change from where we've been over the last 4 years. I think that kind of message is extremely important for a president to maintain. Certainly, how he proceeds with building his cabinet will send some messages to various people. But as I say that, I have to admit that doesn't sound like it's likely to be enough. And I think we really have to develop a means of some serious soul searching. We need to see some people on both sides of the aisle step up and say, we need to get beyond this. We need to find a way to come together. And it's going to have to be a collaborative and cooperative effort. I hope that there will be enough people who are fed up with what we have as a poor excuse for a national government at this time to move forward. But that is all purely speculative today.
You know, we saw the four Democratic freshman female members of Congress who came to national attention as the Squad all win re-election. A number of down-ticket races were won by members of marginalized groups. At the same time, Mitch McConnell, Lindsey Graham, and others targeted by the Democrats with huge amounts of money and effort won re-election with little trouble. Greg, are we seeing districts getting more and more polarized? And if so, why?
I think we are, and I think that it goes back a number of years. There have been a number of scholars who have written about this and the increasing sort of self-selection that goes on in this country, where we find more and more people who think alike tend to seek each other out literally and end up living near each other. I mean, we have watched congressional districts on both, and this applies to both sides, become more and more homogenous over the last 20 years or so. That continues. That's part of the problem. This has to do in part with the way redistricting works in this country now. But it's also a sociological issue. There is this tendency on the part of Americans to move near to where people who agree with them. And this is, as I said, driven in part by the political decisions that are being made under redistricting. It has to do with the influence of social media. It has to do with a lot of things that, while not strictly speaking are political, do have an interface with our political lives. And this is what makes this in part such a huge challenge. You mentioned the Squad and the fact that they were successful in winning, but we see also that a number of Republicans were able to down ballot, were able to pull off election victories. In my home state of New Hampshire, Democrats were fortunate and they managed to keep United States Senator Shaheen in place. The state electoral votes went to Biden. They maintained both of their Democratic members of the House of Representatives. But the state house, House of Representatives and Senate both switched from Democrat to Republican. So there are a lot of different sort of cross messages going on out there, cross currents that we have to try to figure out and deal with. But I think part of the challenge for Democrats now is there will be in the face of a non-existent blue wave. A serious, I'd like to say soul searching, but I think the better word is probably a battle between progressives and moderates, or however you want to define them, in terms of what we did wrong. And the battle will be serious, and it will take a lot of energy, and it will take a lot of time that I would frankly rather see spent figuring out how we pull ourselves back together as a nation.
What lessons should we all learn from how election night went? Again, recognizing that we don't know all of the fallout yet.
Win or lose, Donald Trump will continue to be the significant, the overriding power in the Republican Party, whether he is a second-term president or a former president. I think that will be the case. And I think he will continue to hold great sway over how that moves. Democrats have a more challenging problem in some ways, in that Democrats have been mismanaging some of their mindset and assumptions. And I think particularly about the disappointment that we have heard about in the so-called Hispanic vote. And that what I have just used as a term is a significant part of the problem in this country. There is no Hispanic vote in this country. There are many different Hispanic votes. When we're talking about Cuban Americans in Florida, when we're talking about Mexican Americans in Arizona, where we're talking about South Americans who have relocated here. These are different groups with different concerns, and I think the Democratic Party continues to treat them often as if they're sort of all the same thing. They have different issues. They have different things that matter to them. And we also see, well, and part of that is we sort of assume that if we're talking with Hispanic Americans, we need to be talking about immigration. And that's not true. There are issues, and we saw some of this in the exit polling. Hispanic Americans have some of the same concerns we do. Economic issues are as real for these groups as they are for other segments of the American population. But we need to figure out how to talk about those issues in ways that ring true with these different populations. So I think that I would say the same thing about particularly about African American men, and particularly young African American men. Exactly the same thing is going on there. Economic issues are significant for these groups, but we tend to sort of, Democrats tend to drop them into these overarching categories that don't make sense in the lives of the people we're talking about.
Think about this. You're in front of a classroom and you've got 2 minutes left or 1 minute left, and you say, I want you to never forget from this experience. I want you never to forget what I'm about to say. What would you say?
It's interesting because that is, in a sense, when I'm teaching, has always been sort of the subtext of every course I have taught. And I will answer it maybe a little from a little different perspective, but I think it answers your question. One of the things, because my classes have always been like that, have always represented a wide variety of thought, of political belief, of experience, having had joint programs over the years with Native American students, with Hispanic students, students coming from the Hispanic Caucus, students who are coming from the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation. So I've always had very diverse classes. And I think the underlying theme or approach in a classroom was always to model, if you will, and I'm almost sorry to use this term, but a safe space, a space where people felt comfortable to speak up and people were willing to listen and discuss. And I think that's a model that I try to impart to students that they would carry away in their discussions in the future. A subset of that is something that I often said at the very beginning of my classes when I was talking about political discourse in this country. And it was, and there's a bit, I was going to say a bit of an oversimplification. I'm not sure that it is. And I would say that there was a time in this country when if you disagreed with me, you were wrong. Now it seems if you disagree with me, you're evil. And the difference between those two assumptions has much to do with where we are in this country now. And I lay a lot of the blame, quite frankly, on the rhetoric that we saw come out, have been around for a number of years, in the religious right. That difference between I think you're wrong and I think you're evil has led directly to some of the serious challenges that we face today. I hope that answered your question.
Greg LaBelle is Professor Emeritus of Political Management at George Washington University and the veteran of several presidential campaigns. He's held leadership positions at Interfaith Alliance, among his numerous other credits, and he continues to be a sought-after commentator on matters of politics, ethics, and the common good. Greg, I have to tell you, it's been a great honor and pleasure to be with you. Thank you again for being so generous with your time for State of Belief Radio, and I look forward to when we'll be together again.
Thank you, Weldon. It's always an honor and a privilege to talk with you and to work with you. Thank you.
Faith, religious language, and various individual and collective expressions of values and ethics have been unavoidable in this political era and the election. What this means, both good and bad, and what defenders of religious freedom for all need to focus on next, are all topics that I want to raise with my next guest, Rabbi Jack Moline, president of Interfaith Alliance. Jack, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks, Welton.
While the final outcome of the vote count is uncertain as we speak on this Thursday, what got us to this past Tuesday is less murky. What are your thoughts on what we've seen this week?
That's an interesting question, Welton, because I will say that independent of my concerns about the policies that this administration has pursued over the past 4 years, I have really wondered what it was that endeared the president to so many of his followers. And I really thought that after 4 years of his personal conduct, there would be more of a sense of fatigue with tens of thousands of lies and ignoring certain constitutional and political norms that have always made this country more unified. So I am just stunned that both the popular vote and the Electoral College vote seem to be so close. That is my first takeaway from last Tuesday.
Do you have even a hint yet as to how to answer that question?
I think that that people on both sides of the aisle have done a very good job of creating certain non-negotiable issues, and that a candidate for any office who doesn't toe the line on a particular perspective on those issues is considered to be irrelevant on anything else. I think for the religious right and for a segment of conservative Americans, that issue is abortion. I think for the ultra-liberal left, that issue has to do with matters of personal identity. If there isn't a sort of strictly defined support for those issues, the other things that are of concern to all of us, that bring us all together, that we need to be concerned about, healthcare, the environment, a wise immigration policy, all things that most Americans agree need bipartisan attention, those things are rejected out of hand. And because the political operatives who have been running these campaigns understand that they can get much farther on a single issue than they can on collaboration. That's where we are, and it's heartbreaking.
Did you observe religious themes woven through the rhetoric on both sides? And to the degree that you did, would you consider it was more than in past elections?
I'm not sure it was more than in past elections, but it was more blatant and more definitive than in past elections. You and I both remember sitting with people who were working with the campaigns during the campaign between Al Gore and George Bush, and hearing how the Bush campaign had woven words of hymns from churches in the South into a lot of his rhetoric, things that were lost on people who were either not Christians or not part of that Southern religious tradition, were turning up as, for lack of a better term, dog whistles, although I don't mean that as negatively as it sounds, in the rhetoric of the presidential candidate. there was a subtlety there that you almost had to admire. There was no subtlety in the appeals to religious voters in this election on either side of the aisle, and in any religious community. I wouldn't even call them dog whistles on both sides. They were just blatant appeals, you know. Vote for me because I believe in God the way that you do. That's just, it's terrible.
So I'm guessing you're not encouraged. Is the discouragement going through your mind going to be part of the challenge that you see ahead?
At Interfaith Alliance, we've always tried to encourage people to take the faith values or the philosophy values that they hold and to bring them to bear on society as a whole. Jesse Jackson once said that anybody who doesn't vote his self-interest is a fool, and anyone who only votes his self-interest is a scoundrel. And I think that that's correct. What we're seeing now is that we have a lot of scoundrels in this country. And what I hope we can encourage as Interfaith Alliance is for people to take a good look at their values, their comprehensive values, not their non-negotiable stand on a single issue, but to ask themselves, if I had to put this country back together again, how would I do it not just for myself, but for my neighbors on either side of me? That's really the message that we have to promote as people who believe in the blessings of this great country.
Against the backdrop of that, which you have said so beautifully, summarize, if you would, for our listeners, Interfaith Alliance's work leading up to November the 3rd. What were the key areas of focus?
Well, I remind everybody what they already know, that we are a 501c3 organization. We were not partisan in our message, though I'm certain that there were people who perceived that our dissatisfaction with a lot of the policies that we've seen out of the Trump administration belied a certain prejudice toward change. That's not necessarily a change in candidates or change in officials, but change in policy, which is definitely where we are. So probably the most prominent thing that we did was to urge people to follow the message I just articulated a little bit, that it's your vote and it should be made by your values. It was the theme of a series of 5 ads that we made that followed people from different faith backgrounds, and including people of no faith background, and the values that they brought to bear in this election season. And the tagline in that in that series of videos was that politics are not the provenance of any one faith or one political party, that our values are those things that impel us to act in a way that is for the common good. That was our message leading up to November 3rd. And it will be our message going forward. There's going to be a resolution to this election. It will come, I hope, at the latest on December 14th, which is the day that the electors meet to officially elect the next president of the United States. But the campaign is over. The votes are all cast. They're being counted. But our job now is to put America back together over what is probably the most fractious and least factual political season that I've witnessed.
Jack, I've heard a lot of people say, how is it possible we couldn't do better than this? You talk to a lot of people on Capitol Hill regularly. What are they saying about how the election process played out this year?
Everyone, Welton, that I've spoken with has been extremely frustrated. I have friends on both sides of the aisle, and I I like them as people, and I admire them as public servants. They all feel buffeted by approaches to politics that they feel they have very little control over, that there are people, Republicans and Democrats alike, whose focus is on winning elections and holding on to power rather than the good of the country. Now, in a lot of ways, that's nothing new, and it isn't unique even to our system in the United States. Power is an aphrodisiac, and once people have it, they're a little reluctant to let go of it. But there has been something hard about that attitude of late, certainly since the second Obama administration, where there's been a desire to wrest away any kind of progress from the other side, lest there be some power that has evaporated as a result of it. We saw it with the way that that the Republicans tried to obstruct any initiative from the second Obama administration, and we saw it in the way the Democrats in the House of Representatives have gotten in the way of COVID relief bills because of things that really don't have to do with COVID relief. It's just something that frustrates everybody, and nobody knows exactly where that pressure point is.
What do we need to do better in terms of educating Americans about the role of religion in the founders' vision as well as in the Constitution? I'm asking that because I think recent events may offer an opportunity to do that, with many people newly alert to the influence religious language and convictions of the few are having on all of us.
Well, first of all, we need to reject the notion that the underpinning of the Constitution is the Bible. And I don't care if you read the Bible liberally or you read it literally. The Bible is not the foundational document of the United States. Now, you and I both, Welton, are believers in the message of the Bible. We may have differences as to what constitutes scripture, and we may have differences as to how it was revealed, but it guides our lives. It is the foundational document of my faith. But it's not the Constitution, and it's not what underlies the Constitution. And therefore, when there are people who would proclaim that they are originalists in both reading the Constitution and reading the Bible, they're not being honest, because there is a relationship between the two, but it's not a foundational relationship. So we have to be diligent in making sure that we understand that what has evolved is our understanding of the mandates of the Constitution parallels what has evolved in our understanding of faith, of religion, which has led some people to create different denominations of major faith traditions and other people to reject the notion of affiliation with an organized religious tradition altogether. But all of us are part of what the motto of this country proclaims, e pluribus unum. We are all members of a society that is one, that has come together out of many. And that's the message that faith in general and Interfaith Alliance has to promote, that we are all children of the same point of origin, I'll call it God, and that we therefore have universal rights that pertain to each of us and universal responsibilities that make demands on each of us.
Regardless of the outcome of this election, the nation is terrifyingly polarized. I think we agree on that. Interfaith Alliance was founded on the promise that religion can be a force for good in the nation without subverting political power to the service of any sect or denomination. So, what would you counsel anyone hearing us today to recommit to with the objective of defending and protecting true religious freedom for all. And you can feel free by starting with the suggestion that they become members of Interfaith Alliance, if you wish.
Well, certainly if you want to give a practical expression to that ideal, becoming a member of Interfaith Alliance is probably a great way to do it. And listening weekly to State of Belief will keep you informed as to why that's a good decision. But here's what I'd say, Welton, and I'm planning to say something like this publicly before too long. What is important right now is not to seek vengeance against the people who are our opponents. It is important now to embrace each other and to affirm each other. If our listeners are like me, I want to be sure that those people who dissent from my message are not mocked in our society, but are embraced as an essential voice in deliberation. And if our listeners are like me, I also want to make sure that those people who dissent from what I believe in remain dissenters and not policymakers. So it's a careful balance. The person who lives next to you, either physically or politically, is your brother or your sister, and needs to be treated as family, and not family who's had too much to eat and too much to drink at Thanksgiving dinner, but family who is in need and needs to be tended to.
Rabbi Jack Moline is president of Interfaith Alliance, protecting true religious freedom for all. Jack, you probably know better than anyone else that I really wanted you to be in that office doing what you're doing. And this conversation today just verifies that in me over and over again. I thank you for being where you are and what you're doing, and I thank you for regularly being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Well, Welton, you're too kind, but I'd like to recommend that personality trait to everybody who's listening.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be a part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.